Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week government woke up after a holiday slumber with a slew of swearing-in ceremonies and political posturing. We'll get the latest from Washington and closer to home. Also, one Utah lawmaker is breaking ranks with his GOP colleagues over the proposed prison relocation. We'll find out more about the controversial move. From the health desk, we've got flu deaths, measles cases, and the ongoing debate over banning wood burning. And former House Speaker Becky Lockhart remains in critical condition from an undisclosed illness, an update and reaction. The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got lots of politics, a prison move, wood smoke, and much more. And joining me this morning to talk about the week's news, Tribune investigative reporter Matt Canna. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, senior political reporter Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Health and environment editor Rebecca Walsh is back. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
And also joining us by phone from the nation's capital, Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Thomas, good morning.
Good morning.
And you can join us, too. If there's a news story on your mind, you can send your questions, your comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put your comments on the website, sltrib.com, or call us live, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We got to start with politics. And Mia Love, of course, sworn in as Utah's new 4th Congressional District Representative. Tommy, you were there. Tell us about the pomp and circumstance.
You know, I've covered several swearing-in of new freshmen, several from Utah, and I've never seen one just like this before. I popped into Mia Love's office early in the morning, and there's just a line of people waiting to get in to greet her, to get their picture taken with her. And, you know, just a few minutes in, here comes the House Majority Whip Steve Scalise to say hi. You know, 20 minutes later, there's Paul Ryan, you know, the congressman from Wisconsin, who was the GOP vice presidential candidate, who then took Mia Love to the House floor, where she got a kiss on the cheek from the Speaker of the House. Afterwards, you know, plenty of people wanting to talk to her, reporters surrounding her. It really does show what a star she is already.
So what's her agenda? What did she say?
You know, we're going to have to wait and see. She's really sticking to the talking points she used during the campaign, the theme of, you know, Utah matters, and I'm here to fight for Utah, and I was elected here. And she's really trying to stay away in some way from the national politics. Of course, she did appear on ABC News this week, last Sunday, and she was on Greta Van Susteren on Fox News, I believe, yesterday. So she's still getting some national attention, but she's still trying to stick with, you know, the same point she got elected with, and not stray away to go, you know, all national, all Hollywood on everyone.
And there were some other swearing-ins as well, but they did not garner the attention that Mia Love's did.
It certainly seemed that case. You know, obviously, there's a lot of, as you said, pomp and circumstance, pageantry that goes around the swearing-in. We all know what's going to happen, but everyone is there to cover it and see it. You know, she got a nice seat. She sat towards the back, but on the aisle with Barbara Comstock of Virginia, another freshman. She brought her three kids to sit next to her when she raised her right hand to take the oath. You know, the Speaker of the House, Boehner, was very excited to say hi to her when they did their ceremonial swearing-in later that day. But, you know, it was a big deal for her parents to fly in and other family members to be there. And so now's the test, though. Now she's sworn in. Now she's official. So what is she going to do with it? And so far, her votes have been, you know, pretty down, you know, what vote Boehner and the majority team wanted to vote on. She voted for the Speaker Boehner. We're expecting the vote later today on the Keystone Pipeline, and we expect that she'll support that, of course. So we haven't really seen anything that's been out of the ordinary with her as we expected.
Matt, you along with Tommy and Robert, all three authors right here, wrote a book about Mia Love, spent a lot of time reporting on her and her campaign. Is there anything that strikes you about her transition from candidate to now representative?
She's done exactly what she says she's going to do. What's a little surprising is how much frustration she's already felt from the right wing of her party. That vote for John Boehner really surprised some people, and I think if you actually followed her in her campaign, it shouldn't have. she had stepped away from the Tea Party. She had said that she wants to be very successful in Congress, and to do that, she's going to be a part of the majority, and she's not going to alienate party leadership right from the start. But she got a lot of feedback real quickly, so much so that she felt she had to go out and defend that vote already right from the bat. The second thing, and Tommy covered the party that the Congressional Black Caucus had right before the swearing in. Mia Love has decided to join that all-Democrat group, should be the one Republican. And she didn't show up for that party. But she also, on Greta Van Susteren yesterday...
They had a seat for her with her name on it, and just sat there empty for the entire performance they had, the event they had for the Congressional Black Caucus.
But it's still a talking point. Greta Van Susteren brought it up on Fox News, and she keeps saying what she said throughout, is that she wants to change that group from the inside out. And I think from what Tommy found is that's going to be pretty hard to do, right, Tommy?
Well, she first has to show up to the meetings. I think it'd be a good start. But I talked to several members of the Congressional Black Caucus about that, and one of the best was Elijah Cummings from Maryland, who said, you know, that's not a great attitude when you join a group is to immediately say, I'm going to change it.
Right. Robert, observations?
Just to sort of reiterate what Matt said, the outrage over the Boehner vote sort of surprised me a little bit because, I mean, here's a guy who came out and campaigned for her twice, helped her raise a ton of money. You know, they spoke highly of each other back and forth, and he sort of legitimized her candidacy in the 2012 race. And so it was a no-brainer that that's who she was going to vote for. And I guess the flip side is she could have voted for Louis Gohmert and gotten, you know, stripped of a committee assignment like some of these other people did. It was a no-brainer, but I guess there were expectations from some in the Tea Party here that she might rock the boat a little bit more. But that doesn't seem to be what she's said she's going to do, and it doesn't seem to be where she's going.
Hmm. Tommy, let's move on to Senator Orrin Hatch. She got something of a promotion.
He did, and a nice new title, the Senate President Pro Tempore. It's kind of an honorific title in many ways, but there are actual duties involved in that. So he actually, when the Senate passes legislation, he's the signature, you know, saying that they passed it. He's in charge of making sure that somebody's there to preside over the Senate, because, you know, as we all know, the Vice President, who's the President of the Senate, doesn't really ever show up except for ceremonial things. He also gets, some fun things. I sat down with Senator Hatch in his new office, which is a beautiful, nice space, huge chandelier, views of the expansive mall and the Washington Monument. He gets a security detail. I think he told me there are 22 federal agents now assigned to him around the clock to make
Wow.
sure he's safe, because he is the third in line for the presidency behind the vice president and speaker. So Orrin Hatch, a few heartbeats away from the presidency now.
And Senator Lee also got a new assignment. And tell us what it is and what does it say about his position in the body?
Yes, yeah, so Senator Lee was elected chairman of the Senate Steering Committee, which is kind of the more right flank of the Senate majority now. And as part of that, he becomes counsel to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's one of four counsels to McConnell, which is interesting because Senator Bennett, whom Lee replaced, was also a counsel to Mitch McConnell. But it means that Lee's going to be in the room for, you know, discussions on, you know, strategy and what they should do, which is going to be fun since Mitch McConnell and Mike Lee don't see eye to eye on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. In other news from Washington, President Obama has nominated a Utah to serve on the Federal Reserve Board. Who is this guy, Alan Landon?
So Alan Landon is a partner in a community band capital, and he's the former chairman and chief executive officer of the Bank of Hawaii, which I'm guessing is where he got to know President Obama, because they do have some history. Actually, Landon, who's a Park City resident, spoke at Obama's grandmother's funeral. She died a couple days before Obama was elected in 2008, and Landon, the Utah, was the guy who actually spoke at the funeral and read a letter from Obama and his half-sister about Madeleine Dunham. So they must have known each other for some time, but this is a pretty big role for Landon to serve on, because you know the Federal Reserve sets economic policy. It's the nation's central bank, and this is a very long term appointment too. He gets appointed through 2016, and essentially there's a reappointment that happens. So he'll be serving until 2030. as one of the nation's, you know, top monetary policy officials. And he lives right there in Park City.
Hmm. Any controversy surrounding the nomination? Do you expect any opposition?
Not so far. Obviously, there are those who will use the opportunity of his nomination to push to audit the Federal Reserve. That's just kind of expected whenever there's a nominee. But he did get some early support on. The Community Bankers Association came out with a statement saying it's good to have somebody who's been a community banker and not just a Wall Street guy to serve on the Federal Reserve. I haven't heard any other controversy since his appointment, and assuming this will probably fly through.
Okay. Tommy, I know you need to get on your way. Anything else out of Washington? That listeners might be interested in.
Well, there's there are fewer Democrats around these days, it seems to be. that's about the big difference. I will note real fast that excuse me. We should all be very impressed that it snowed on Tuesday and the D.C. government did not shut down. Like, the whole Capitol actually worked, which is amazing for anyone who's ever worked in Washington. Usually two snowflakes shut it down, but not this time around.
Not this time. Sorry, Tommy. You had to go to work. Tommy Berg joining us from Washington. And, Thomas, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Again, we're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, talking about the week's news. If you want to join us, you can send your thoughts to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. Call us, 801-355-TALK is the number. Mia Love, others are not the only ones who were sworn in today or this week. Other swearing-ins around the state. The highest profile is probably Sean Reyes as the new Utah Attorney General. And Robert, you were there. Tell us about the event.
Well, it was an interesting ceremony because, you know, in a lot of years you end up having the Attorney General also being sworn in addition to the governor and others. But since he was the only statewide official on the ballot this year, he's the only one being sworn in. The ceremony had this very distinctive multicultural flavor. I mean, his father, who's has Filipino heritage, played music, and there was Hawaiian music, and there was Spanish music, and it was kind of different, obviously, than what we typically see up there.
So he's making history too.
Yeah, I mean, he's the first statewide or first ethnic minority to be elected statewide. Obviously, he's served for a year since he was appointed last year, but he is the first ethnic minority to hold a statewide office, and it definitely had that ethnic flavor to it, multicultural flavor to it. He really focused in his comments on sort of what he's done to sort of reform the office since the scandal 2 years ago, and since the John Swallow resigned in November, and leading to Sean Reyes being sworn in. He focused on that. He focused on, as he put it, making it a law office and not a political office, and focusing on doing the right thing by the law and not doing what's politically expedient. So he recognizes that there was a stigma, a stain left on the office when he came in, and he says he's been working for the past year to try to restore the public's trust in the office, and he believes he's done that.
This is sort of the next in, there's an anniversary this week of the
right.
scandal breaking, and I guess it's been 2 years since your first story talked about alleged corruption in the office. Give us an update on the charges, where things are with John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff.
Right. It's kind of hard to believe it's been 2 years. It's gone by fast. But they've set preliminary hearings for June for Attorney General Swallow. He's, he and Mark Shurtleff are still facing these felony charges. There is a tremendous amount of evidence that is being gathered and collected, and so they're going to have to give the defense attorney some time to go through that. There's not going to be a quick resolution to this through the court system. Tim Lawson, I believe, has a preliminary hearing coming up here shortly. He was Mark Shurtleff's quote unquote fixer, a friend of his who's, you know, being charged with several crimes related to the scandal. Jeremy Johnson is still pending. You know, it's going even probably slower than these others. You know, he's in federal court, and that thing's dragging on for a long time. So it's been, I mean, in the 2 years, you look back on what's transpired. We've had investigations by the Lieutenant Governor's office, by the House of Representatives, that both found problems, that, you know, wrongdoing that led to changes in the state law. You had the criminal charges, obviously, that that have transpired, and you have a series of changes that Attorney General Reyes has instituted in the office to try to, in the future, reduce the appearance that there could be some favoritism or influence bought in the office. And so, you know, it's been significant changes. Ultimately, you know, from the people I've talked to this week, you can make all the changes you want. If you have people that are going to break the law, as Attorney General Swallow and Attorney General Shurtleff are accused of having done, they, to be clear, maintain they're innocent and that they're going to be acquitted, and you know, this whole thing will be shown to be a sham. But if you have people who are going to break the law, then there's really not much you can do. You can pass all the laws you want. It's not going to stop them. So, so that's where we are today, 2 years later.
You've got some analysis coming up in this weekend's paper, I believe.
Yeah, there. You know, we've been talking to some of the key players about sort of what's been done and what the lessons are that, you know, can be learned from this whole saga. And so that'll be coming up this weekend.
Any other charges pending? Do we have any sense of that?
The prosecutors have sort of left that possibility open, I guess. And so we're going to see what comes. Again, they have until June, it looks like now, before the preliminary hearing, and they can amend those charges pretty much anytime they want. It's something that we'll be continuing to watch for.
Really looking forward to this this weekend's package. Again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. We'll be right back after a break. Stick around. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and in studio reporters Robert Gerke and Matt Canham, health and environment editor Rebecca Walsh, and of course, we're talking about the week's top stories. You can join us by sending tweets to the hashtag TribTalk or putting your comments at sltrib.com. Let's move to this real hot-button issue, the prison relocation. A state lawmaker this week broke ranks on moving the prison. Maybe tell us more, Matt, about Representative Merrill Nelson's reservations.
Yes. Merrill Nelson represents Grantsville, which is right next to one of the potential prison sites, and he is very frustrated that it still remains on the list. This site in Tooele County is right next to the Miller Motorsports Park. And if you talk to Tooele County officials, they saw this as their big economic development area. They wanted hotels and restaurants, and they wanted shops. Not a prison. It's right next to their one community center where there's a big kids swimming pool. And he couldn't think of a worse place in his county for this prison to go. And even though the county and he and other people in Tooele County have raise these concerns, the Prison Relocation Commission keeps it on the list. He's so frustrated about it, he is planning to offer legislation that would allow the prison to remain in Draper. Now, what happened in 2014, in January of 2014, the last session, there were two votes. One of the votes was, should the prison move? And the legislature passed a resolution overwhelmingly saying, yes, it should. Merrill Nelson voted for that. The second was creating the Prison Relocation Commission and creating the rules. He voted for that. What his bill would do would say would tweak those rules and say it can move, but it also can stay right where it is and just be remodeled.
So this change of heart, is it political pressure? Is that what it is?
You know, he's heard a lot, but he also is just frustrated personally. He thought that they would look for a much more rural site than the Prison Relocation Commission has decided to look for. The commission wants a prison that's close to the courts, that is close to the hospitals, is close to a lot of police backup. And I think Merrill thought it'd be way out in the boonies, and sure, we can find plenty of spots in this vast state of ours that's nowhere near a city. Well, now they're looking near cities, and he just is very frustrated with the process.
Do you think his arguments are going to resonate with his colleagues on Capitol Hill?
Frustrated the commission chairman, Representative Brad Wilson, who I talked to. He was blindsided by this, and he thinks it's not going to carry weight. But it is a sign that this is such a heavy political left. Last session, this overwhelming votes, that's not going to hold. There is going to be some concern about how this happens when you get down to the actual individual sites. And I think that's the indication. Whether this is going to really pass or not, I think we'll have to wait to see.
I want to turn to a story at sltrib.com this morning. Trouble brewing in Eagle Mountain, one of the sites that's being looked at for this new prison. One state senator supports it. Another state representative opposes it. Both hold sway in this community. Tell us about the controversy.
So in Eagle Mountain, one of the three sites, there's the one in Twilla County, there's one near the airport in Salt Lake City, and there's one in Eagle Mountain. And the Eagle Mountain one is actually land owned by the founder of Eagle Mountain, and he is a big figure in that community. He still owns 6,500 acres. He plans to build 22,000 houses out there. He also wouldn't mind having a prison on some of his land. The people out there are very upset about it. The state representative, David Liffrith, is very... He engages with the public quite a bit, and he's been on their side, the mayor, the city council. There's a lot of outcry against the prison, and the person who hasn't said anything is Senator Mark Mattson, who used to work for the owner of that prison site, who is still remains to be very close to him and has tried to help him through this process, get contacts with the prison commission, try to convince the mayor that it's a good idea. He's been silent until he talked to us. And the thing I found most surprising is he had no idea that people were tying him to the former developer. His conflict disclosure, which lists who he gets paid from, lists Eagle Mountain Properties, which is owned by the developer. His bio on the state Senate website lists his job as developer of Eagle Mountain Properties. And he said that's 5 years old. He forgot to change it, apparently never looks at it, and didn't know that people were repeatedly talking about it because he doesn't read the news and didn't check his email very closely.
Well, his interactions or lack thereof have been very frustrating to a lot of the community activists in Eagle Mountain, right?
Well, they just assume that when you email your state senator, not just any state senator, but the one who represents you, that you would get some sort of response, or at least someone in your group would get some sort of response. He has not only ignored the community group. He's ignored the city council of Eagle Mountain. He's ignored the mayor of Eagle Mountain. He's ignored his friend David Liffrith, who's in the House of Representatives. He won't return their calls either. Actually, surprisingly, John Walden, the developer, said he has a hard time getting hold of him as well.
Well, maybe Robert, what's going to happen on the Hill? I mean, is this going to be an issue? It's certainly been a grassroots issue at this point. Is it going to be an issue for lawmakers?
Well, not to diminish the influence of people like David Liffrith and Merrill Nelson, but you've got people, as Matt mentioned, Brad Wilson, who's been on this committee. He's in leadership. You've got the House Speaker, who's pretty who represents Draper and wants this prison moved. You've got Wayne Niederhauser, who you know represents Sandy, who's right near Draper, that wants the prison moved. You've got the governor, who wants the prison moved. It seems at this point highly unlikely they're not going to move it somewhere. And so for a representative from individual communities to try to stop this thing, it seems like a long shot. Maybe they can band together and say it needs to stay put, get behind this Merrill Nelson bill, and all the representatives from all the communities can band together and, you know, get behind that bill. But it looks like it's going to move somewhere, and the question at this point is where and when. I guess, you know, the time frame on this isn't necessarily this session. You know, decisions aren't going to be made this session. It's going to be down the road a ways, and so there is some time for some other things to play out.
Mm-hmm. Where does the conversation about the relocation go now, Matt?
Well, because of this huge public outcry, the commission has tried to pump the brakes a little bit and said, hey, if anyone else has any other land we should look at, send it our way, and we'll look at it till the end of this month. So they're just kind of in a wait period. Mm. And so they're going to have some meetings during this legislative session. But there's a lot of analysis that goes into land. I mean, you're trying to buy 500 acres to build a prison on. You need to know a lot about that land, about the infrastructure that's going out to it, the roads, the sewer, electricity. There's a lot of research that goes into that. So right now they're looking at three sites. When they start looking at one, it's going to take time, mm-hmm. which is why it seems unlikely this is going to be decided by the end of this legislative session in March.
Hmm. Okay. We will keep an eye on prison relocation. I want to move on to some health issues because there's been a lot of health news this week. And Rebecca, one story that the Tribune's been following, of course, is this proposed ban on wood smoke. The governor is asking for public input. Tell us more.
Yes, so DEQ has a series of 7 public hearings in the affected counties along the Wasatch Front that are out of attainment for PM2 particulate pollution during the winter. The first is next Wednesday in Tooele. The next will be next Thursday in Salt Lake City, and they basically want the public's input on this idea that Governor Herbert and DEQ has proposed of banning wood burning along the Wasatch Front from November 1st to March 1st. This rule would not take effect until next inversion season, starting in November.
So you're talking wood burning, fireplaces,
wood stoves, coal stoves, pellet burning devices, no burning. This would exempt canyon communities above 7,000 feet, and it would also exempt restaurants and businesses that have charcoal grills. But you as a person could not use your own charcoal grill on your patio.
I see. Air quality advocates fully behind this?
For the most part, I think so, yes. There's the Hearth and Patio Association, which is based in California, is very opposed to this idea, and so we expect some fairly significant pushback from them. And we also expect that there may be some members of the public who will push back. We've seen in Salt Lake County, which also strengthened its wood burning rules this week, that the public is not universally behind this idea. They feel like this is a government intrusion in their ability to do what they want to do in their own homes.
And yet the County Board of Health still went ahead with banning.
Yes,
the
on
burn.
Thursday, the County Board of Health decided to add voluntary burn days to its list of no burn days. So it basically doubles the number of days in Salt Lake County when you cannot burn. They will not start enforcing this until next January 1st, but they said that they will go after people who seem to be deliberately burning on voluntary days.
So if people want to comment on this, they can go to a public hearing. Are there other ways they can participate?
Yes, I think DEQ has a comment portal on their website, and I don't know that the county is still taking comments, but DEQ is taking comments,
okay.
Written comments.
Well, let's move on to infectious diseases, because we've heard a bit about the flu. It's a tough flu season already. We're only about midpoint. 9 deaths already reported in Salt Lake County. What's going on?
Well, they expected a tough flu season this year because they predicted that the H3N2 strain, which is the more virulent strain and lasts longer and makes you sicker, seemed to be surging last fall. And add to that the fact that the current vaccine strain is only effective in 30% of the viruses. So the deaths this year are 9 in Salt Lake County. That's compared to 6 at this point in the year last year. But the hospitalizations are double. 400 people have been hospitalized in Salt Lake County, and last year at this time it was 200. 700 across the state have been hospitalized. All the deaths so far in Salt Lake County are people over 65, which unfortunately is the expected age group. What we would be watching for is if there are pediatric cases that arise.
Mm-hmm. Any other deaths anywhere else in the state?
We had 2 deaths in Weber-Morgan counties. Neither of those were pediatric, and 85 people have been hospitalized in those 2 counties.
Are people not getting the flu shot? I mean, is that contributing to this?
We haven't heard that. The health department is still encouraging people to go get vaccinated because the flu season can last through May, and in tough years can go on for a long time. So they say people should still go try to get vaccinated. Even if it's only effective in 30% of the viruses, it will make your sickness last not as long. You'll be able to throw it off quicker.
Okay. Another infectious disease in the headlines this week, the measles. A couple of measles cases were reported.
Yes. 2 Utah County juveniles came back from Disneyland around the first of the year.
Watch out, Robert. You're headed there this weekend.
I know. I'm heading there next week.
Don't touch any rails. two kids apparently contracted measles. They are part of an outbreak in Southern California that 7 people in California have been confirmed cases as well, and then the 2 in Utah. So these 2 kids apparently were not vaccinated as children, and so they contracted measles. They've come back here. They've been to a couple of grocery stores when they were infectious. They went to Macy's and Walmart and 2 movie theaters, and
oh,
they went to
goodness.
Church. So the Utah County Health Department is asking people who may have been at those places at the same time as these kids to watch themselves for symptoms, and if people do develop symptoms, they'll be quarantined in their own homes.
How unusual is the measles outbreak these days?
Unfortunately, not as unusual as you would expect. I think California gets a lot of them because they have a lot of people who don't vaccinate their kids with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
Highly contagious.
Very, very contagious. 90% of those who are not vaccinated will catch it if they're exposed to it.
Okay. Well, there's an argument for vaccination. All right. Yes. Let's move on to e-cigarettes. And there's a huge new study out that shows this disparity in what people are vaping. Give us more detail.
The Salt Lake County Health Department reviewed smoke shops, vape shops, to check the nicotine content in e-cigarettes and compare it to the actual labeling. The industry has a standard that these nicotine contents should be within 10% of the label. But what the Salt Lake County Health Department found is, I think it was 70 out of 120 e-cigarettes varied widely from their labeling. Some of them were as much as 88% less than the label said nicotine content, and some were 840% more nicotine content than the label. So you really don't know what you're getting when you buy an e-cigarette. So county health departments throughout the state seem to be back on their heels and are trying to get a handle on this industry and figure out how to regulate it, how to help the public know that what they're getting is really what they think they're getting. At the same time, Logan City banned e-cigarettes in public places and at parks this week.
Is there a sense that the vape shops are mixing, the ones that mix their own concoctions are grossly out of proportion if they're importing stuff? I mean, did the study go into that particular point?
Not specifically, but I think there's just concern that it's not consistent, that nobody seems to have a handle on this. It's very unregulated right now, and the county health departments are just trying to get a handle on it.
So regulation, is that going to be on the legislative agenda, Robert?
You know, the last several years, the legislature's really struggled with how to regulate these e-cigarettes. You know, I mean, I remember the first years they were trying to decide, you know, do they fit under the Clean Air Act or the Indoor Clean Air Act? And they did, you know, they banned it indoors. They're still trying to, especially people like Representative Paul Ray are trying to get a handle on how legislatively to regulate these e-cigarettes. And it's not just a matter of, and they're trying to do it on a statewide level rather than, you know, letting the counties get out in front of in front of this issue. They tried to get it done last year. They weren't able to do it. He's going to be back with a bill this year, similar to the one last year. And he got substantial pushback from the industry last year and is expecting it again this year. And at some point he said, well, you know, if we can't get it done at the legislative level, then maybe the counties can do what they want to do. And the industry doesn't like that, because then you end up with this patchwork of laws, and you end up with some counties that want to go a lot further than the state would go in terms of regulating e-cigarettes. So it will definitely be an issue up there. Whether they can get it across the finish line, is always the question, I guess, as the session rolls on.
Sure. So Rebecca, what is Salt Lake County? What are the options for them?
They're still reviewing. I think their big concern is that kids may be using these. There have been some cases of toddlers being overdosing on them, on finding their parents' e-cigarettes and sucking on them, because they're bubblegum flavor, they're green apple flavor, they're nice and colorful, they look like candy, and for some teenagers it may be seen sort of as like drinking a Red Bull. Mm-hmm. So I think that's some of these health departments' biggest concern, is that kids might have access to these. So all of the counties are reviewing what they can possibly do, while the state is also acting on another front.
Rebecca Walsh from the Salt Lake Tribune. One other health-related story that made a lot of headlines was the hospitalization of former House Speaker Becky Lockhart. Mm-hmm. She just stepped down this week. News broke that she's critically ill. What do we know about her condition?
Well, the family's been guarded with her condition. They've asked for privacy, and they've asked for, you know, they've acknowledged that she was critically ill. They haven't disclosed what the illness is. It came on fast. I mean, I interviewed her on December 4th and interacted with her subsequent to that for a story I was working on about her leaving the legislature. Mm-hmm. Her term ended December 31st, and they acknowledged, I believe it was on the 4th or 5th of this month, that she was critically ill. They haven't given any updates publicly, except, you know, you can assume it's very serious, and they've not released anything about a prognosis publicly yet.
What's been the reaction in political circles?
I think people were shocked. I mean, she's 46 years old, so she's young, mother of three, you know, and to be dealing with something like this as soon, you know, especially immediately after she leaves office, it shocked a lot of people. You know, obviously a lot of prayers were going out for her and her family. You know, it's one of those things. When I interviewed her last month, we spent a good amount of time talking about what she plan to do after she left the legislature. She was working on a book about women in leadership. She wanted to do more in sort of that realm. She was talking about going back to graduate school and had made some contacts with the Harvard graduate school program to go out there. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether she was going to run for governor. So, you know, it was shocking, I think, given that, you know, again, as young as she was, and you assume that, you know, she's, you know, there's plenty of time to do this, and then to have something hit this hard, I guess, and, mm-hmm. and put her in such a dire situation, I think was shocked everybody.
Mm-hmm. What's her legacy?
Well, I mean, that was what the focus of the story was that we were talking about. And she said her legacy is that she feels like she brought a collaborative style to the legislature. The previous speakers had sort of consolidated power. They ran a tight ship and kept tight control over the body. She said what she likes to think she did is she sort of diffused the power and let all of the representatives feel like they were contributing and all of their ideas were worthwhile. And her other legacy, obviously, is that she's the first female Speaker of the House. And you know, Representative Jen Selig, who was the minority leader at the same time, said that's important for women to see. And the Speaker acknowledged as well that it's important for women to see women in leadership roles, you know, because now young girls growing up say, well, that's something I can do, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think those two things are a legacy, in addition to, you know, some of the stances she took in contrast combating the governor's office on things like Medicaid reform, and as well as, you know, leading sort of the investigation into the attorney general that ultimately, you know, may have forced him out of office and found some fairly significant wrongdoing. It was notable at the time that the House did that, because this is a Republican-dominated House investigating a Republican attorney general, and they were very thorough and very aggressive in that. So I think those things are her legacy, and she feels like she's brought that, like I said, the collaborative style, the collaborative atmosphere to the House. During her tenure.
Is that going to last under the new speaker?
I think so, because I think, you know, Speaker Hughes has already kind of made overtures to, he's aware that he's got a very young House. Most of these guys haven't served for more than one or two terms, three terms, you know, on the outside. And so it's, you know, he's got a young group, but he's also acknowledged that he's got a group of people with various expertise, right? And he talks about health reform. He talks about how many doctors and health insurance experts and sort of people with a medical background are there. And he says those are the people that are going to kind of guide this. They have people with expertise in different areas. And he said he's going to try to be, you know, inclusive and listen to those people and let them contribute to the conversation.
Mm. Well, we wish Representative Lockhart well, and look forward to hearing more as you hear it, Robert.
I think we'll have some updates fairly soon.
Talking about the week's news, we invite you to chime in too. 801-355-TALK is our number. Put your comments at sltrib.com. We'll be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCBW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And here in studio, Rebecca Walsh, Matt Canham, and Robert Gerke. You're welcome to join us at 801-355-TALK. Put your comments at sltrib.com or send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. A study out of BYU, Rebecca. tell us about this study.
Yes, well, I think this story sort of shows us the importance of semantics and use of words. The BYU has been working for 30 years at a cemetery outside of Cairo, about 60 miles south of Cairo, unearthing bodies and studying the textiles and the way that the bodies are preserved and religious iconography that they're finding, and have a longstanding history working there. Well, one of the researchers was delivering a paper in Toronto in November, and in an offhand comment that was sort of interpreted and headlined by media, it became the Million Mummy study.
Million mummies,
which can be offensive to the Egyptians. Mummies are a very specific group of people who were buried.
Oh,
and as well, it was also considered a big announcement, and that is something that should be left to Egypt's antiquities ministry. So the Egyptians were very upset about this and the way it came out. They felt like some protocol had been broken. So BYU's permit to work at this cemetery was put on hold, suspended, threatened. We're not really clear on it. BYU has been very careful since that point in terms of what they will say about it because they don't want to make the situation worse.
Sure.
So the last word we got, which was in today's story, is that BYU believes that their permit is fine and that they will be able to continue working there. They don't want to jeopardize this three-decade-long relationship. It's a fascinating place that they've been working at. They've found crosses and perhaps representations of the Madonna, and this cemetery is considered to be sort of at the threshold of Christianity in Egypt. So it's a very important place, and I'm sure very important to BYU from its own perspective. So they're hoping that things have been resolved and they can continue working there.
Okay. Who decides? It's solely in the hands of the Egyptian government?
It's up to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians have not responded to our request for comment. They haven't clarified whether or not the permit is still in place. BYU believes that it is.
All right. Well, we will move on to our underplayed story of the week, story that you think will continue to play on and as may have been under the radar given some of the other big stories this week. Matt, let's start with you.
All right. 2015 is also an election year, but it's for mayors of cities. And in Salt Lake City, it looks like we're going to have a pretty interesting election. The mayor, Ralph Becker, has decided he's running again.
Third term
he's going for.
Speaking of third term.
And now Luke Garrett, who's one of the city councilmen, has also said he's going in. What happened this week on Tuesday that our colleague Chris Smart wrote about is pretty interesting. The city council every year picks a new chairman. And this year they picked Luke Garrett, which is whether it's a signal or not that they support him.
But it was unanimous.
It was unanimous. It was 6-1. Luke didn't vote for himself, which from what I can tell is kind of a tradition.
Okay.
And so, you know, whether that is a signal that they support him or not, it does give him an elevated platform in an election year. The chairman, you know, helps set the agenda, speaks for the council on many issues, and he's going to have that platform to combat Mayor Becker on a variety of issues. And this isn't the only news in this area this week.
Right. Another candidate has thrown in.
Right. Jackie Biskupski, who works for the Salt Lake County Sheriff and is a former state lawmaker in Salt Lake City, also is going to run. And she has a long following from her time as a state lawmaker. She's, I think, if Gerke can back me up on this, I think she was the first openly gay state
That's
lawmaker.
Right. Yeah.
And she is a very aggressive political personality, and she's jumping headfirst in this as well this week.
Can you remind us a little bit about her service? It was a while ago, wasn't it? About a decade, maybe.
You're gonna make me struggle on
this.
She served for quite a while, but I think she just retired. I believe it was maybe 8 years ago. It might have been six.
Hmm.
Yeah, and she rose to a leadership position in the minority caucus. She was the first openly gay legislator, and I think it was 6 years ago that she left. Yeah, and she's a prominent figure in Democratic circles, and I think given her work in the county has sort of a knowledge of the issues that the city's facing and could actually, you know, mount a pretty aggressive and or maybe a legitimate campaign. She's been preparing for this for a while, and there's been talk about her running for a number of years, and she's kind of sat on the sidelines for the last couple cycles. And I don't know if it was maybe Councilman Garrett getting into the race that triggered her decision to jump in, but she's in, and so, you know, we've got three now and probably more down the road.
Mm-hmm. City politics heating up, something
it's
to watch.
Very interesting.
Okay. Robert, what's your pick for the underplayed story of the week?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. A few years ago at the legislature, I covered the passage of this ag gag law, the law that prohibits people from taking pictures of sort of meat processing sites, farms, that sort of thing. And there have been some California activists who've been charged under this law. And now they're sort of they're expected to enter not guilty pleas, and there's sort of been an anticipation that there would ultimately be a constitutional challenge to this bill, and that may be where this is headed. Mm-hmm. They took some pictures of some pigs that were, I guess had been shipped from California to Utah, or maybe it was the other way. I'm sorry if I forgot. And you know that was considered a violation, and they were charged. And so
what are the charges?
Well, it's against the law. And I can't remember if it's I think it might be a Class B misdemeanor. It might mm-hmm. be Class A. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if I. But you know it's just against the law to take pictures of these facilities. And the question is, can you take pictures of them from a public place, sort of pointing in, or if you surreptitiously go into them, are you obviously you could be charged with trespassing, but is it also an additional violation of the quote ag gag law? So you know there could be a significant fight over this. There have been similar laws passed especially in sort of farming states across the country. And so, you know, this is not unique to Utah, but it is, as far as I'm aware, the first test of the law in Utah.
I believe it is the first test. That's certainly a story to continue to follow. Rebecca Walsh, your pick.
My pick is some comments from the West Valley City Mayor, Ron Bigelow, this week, where he apparently believes that the media either edited or spliced or blew out of proportion the Rodney King beating video from Los Angeles. He referenced it in arguing against opening up some city records to the media. I find that interesting. Given that one of the most diverse cities in our state is led by this man, I think people there deserve a further explanation of what he really believes happened in the Rodney King video.
Rodney King?
How long ago was that?
How long ago was that? Like 20 years ago? 25 years ago?
Well, and yeah. It's interesting. When he brought this up, it was Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle was arguing before the city council to get records in a police shooting that happened there that one of the officers involved, we've heard no explanation of what his role was or what the police found in their investigation. And they're saying because they decided not to charge him or take any action because he retired, that they're not giving us the records. And so Nate asked the city council, which the mayor is a member of, to overrule that decision.
Hmm.
We won't know for a while, probably till next Tuesday, what they're going to do. And if they follow what the mayor said, who was criticizing the media for manipulating information, then if they say no, the Tribune then would have to go to court to try to get these documents on this police shooting.
Well, and it's interesting to me that the Rodney King reference in particular, I mean, the racial component and the historic component of it aside, it was sort of one of the first times we had video of a news event.
Mm.
And now this stuff is
ubiquitous.
And it was
pretty clear what happened in
yeah.
that video.
Right. And yeah,
well.
You could watch the whole thing. And now these videos are everywhere.
Sure.
You know, every news event, there's somebody with a cell phone, you know, taking pictures of it. We live in a different world than we did when we
Absolutely.
Had during the Rodney King video. And you know, it's interesting that he harkens back 20 plus years
yeah.
to that to make that reference.
If I were a constituent of his, I would want some answers.
Well, we'll certainly be asking some questions, I'm sure. My pick for the underplayed story is this idea of raising the gas tax. And legislators talked this week about, you know, it's time. It's been at least 20 years, hasn't it? 1997, so
yeah.
not quite 20 years, but
yeah.
a long time since the gas tax has been raised. They're talking about, I think, a 10-cent a gallon.
Governor Herbert says to recapture inflation because of the way the economy's grown over the last 17 years, they'd have to go up by 11 cents. Yeah.
So I think that is going to be a point of contention because nobody likes to raise taxes.
And there seems to be some political consensus forming behind some sort of gas tax increase.
If the gas prices go up, does this die?
Yeah.
The timing of it is opportune for legislators because you tack an extra 5 cents onto low gas prices.
Yeah.
People don't hurt quite as much. But,
yeah.
You know, and there's different ways to do it. There's indexing the gas tax to try to account for inflation, or there's taking, you know, turning it into a percentage sales tax. There's different ideas, and I think there's some coalescence sort of forming, and we'll see where it goes.
We will see where it goes. Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, Rebecca Walsh, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
A good weekend.
You too. We're going to wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and he's talking about the art of unspoken communication.
there's a little girl in my church, LDS ward, and she's not yet two, but she can sign what she wants.
Wow.
Usually it's candy from me. But I couldn't figure out what was going on the first little while that she was doing it. She's just making these gestures. And then her mother explained that she was teaching her sign language along with, you know, being able to talk.
Now, of course, there's the official American Sign Language.
Right.
But then there are some universals. And you wrote about those.
Oh, yeah.
Those hand gestures back in 2002. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. Signing is not just for the deaf anymore. There are countless situations where ASL would work better than the spoken word. Besides, you already know some sign language. For starters, there is the universal sign for "How dare you cut me off in traffic." The same sign passes for a greeting during a BYU and University of Utah football game. There is also the shrug and glance away that passes for effective response whenever your wife says, "What fathead went to the ATM 6 times last Friday?" Finally, everyone knows that when you want people to stop shooting at you, you raise your arms and surrender. But there is a real need to standardize signing. If someone sees you hopping up and down with a purple face, they may not know that you are trying to say, "I have a bottle cap stuck in my throat." They might think that you're just a poor dancer.
What are the gestures that you find yourself using over and over to communicate something without words?
Well, I use that shrug and look of helplessness whenever my wife accuses me of something. But mostly it's just the basic stuff, you know, like rubbing your stomach when you're hungry and beckoning someone to come here like the dogs when you're not supposed to be outside and you need to get back inside. And those sorts of things. Oh, I blow kisses to my grandkids. They like that. They pretend to catch them and stick them on their butts.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read more Kirby at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis and Max McLeod for their help today. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
This is Tim.